I think what we'll do, we'll just start off and turn it over to whoever is in charge.
Good morning.
You're talking to the microphone.
Good morning. I'm Karen Kaiser. I'm the chairman of the Substance Abuse Advisory Board for Clark County. Welcome all of you this morning to our yearly annual briefing for the Clark County County Commissioners. I welcome Commissioner Tom Mielke and Commissioner David Mador to our briefing this morning. In attendance, we have Deputy Jeff Bacchus from the Sheriff's Department, Sergeant Shane Gardner from the Sheriff's Department, Chairman of the Board, and a current board member. Next to him is Joey Smith, who is on the Executive Board for the Board. Next to Joey is Lieutenant Kathy McNicholas, Executive Board Vice Chair. Jessica DeFries, Board Member. Tom Breitenbach, Board Member. Tiffany Schweiderman, Margaret McCarthy, and Joy Nichols. They are with three coalitions from Clark County. Behind me is Sergeant Tangen from the Sheriff's Department. Nero from the county staff, our staff representative Cindy Smith, and a gentleman in the back that I have not met, so I can't introduce.
And it hangs around here a lot. And we have Commissioner Stewart on her way.
On her way. Okay, great.
Passed your test just fine.
I know. I'm pretty impressed already.
In the spot. So we're going to start off this morning with the legal mandate. Joey?
Yes. Good morning. Joey Smith, board member. Everybody's.
You can pull that right over to you.
Yeah, here we go. Joey Smith, board member. Everybody's envious that I have the exciting legal mandate slide to get us going here. But as the authority and the mandates of the RCW 70.96A-300 and WAC 388-805, I'm going to address the duties and responsibilities of the Substance Abuse Advisory Board. Before I talk about what we do, who are we? And I can tell you that we are a motley crew. The Substance Abuse Advisory Board is made up of individuals in recovery, members from diverse populations, and those representing geographic areas across the county. I can tell you that roughly over half of us are in recovery ourselves, but just about everybody that's on the board has a personal connection, either through family members or their personal experiences that have encouraged them to get involved in the community and do what they can to help our fellow citizens. And then all members of the advisory board have a working knowledge of an interest in issues related to alcoholism, drug addiction, substance abuse, and prevention. And we're well represented from the prevention community today. What we do, we review and assess community needs, services, plans, and budgets for publicly funded treatment and prevention programs, and all of that culminates in what we are doing here today, and that's making recommendations to our county commissioners regarding program needs and priorities. Thank you.
Good morning, commissioners. So this is the exciting time of the year for us. We have all these meetings, and we talk to each other about change that we need in this community, and then we get this opportunity once a year to come before you and give you our recommendations. And most importantly, thank you so much for your support for our programs, because our relationship with Board of County Commissioners has been fantastic. In the 9 years I've been a member of the Substance Abuse Advisory Board, you guys do listen intently to what we say, and I want to express a ton of appreciation for that, because I know that it means a lot to us to feel appreciated for what we do on the Substance Abuse Advisory Board, and you as commissioners do that for us. So I'm just going to talk about a couple things, and the first thing is mostly a journey for me that when, as you know, I'm a 16-year law enforcement officer with Clark County Sheriff's Office. I worked undercover narcotics for 7 years, and it was easy for me at the beginning to put addiction as a choice, and that every house that I served a search warrant on, every informant that I dealt with had chosen that path to go down. And in my experience in law enforcement and through my education of trying to figure out the other side and the angles here, there's plenty of evidence to show that addiction is or substance abuse is an addiction. It's not a choice. There are many ways in our current social structure that youth particularly end up on that path, whether it's the lack of access to health care, where they self-medicate by using alcohol or marijuana and continue down that path of self-medication, that we have people in our comment program that we used to have, the co-occurring disorders that once they got clean and sober, then they'd realize that they were ADHD or they were bipolar, but that would be something that wouldn't be discovered until after they had gotten their substance abuse under control. If we change our mindset as a community to understand that every drug addict that we have out there isn't making the choice, because personal experience, 7 years dealing with plenty of single parents that are drug addicts, there's nobody that would choose that lifestyle that they have. And if we look at it that it's a chronic brain disease and that it's an addiction, it gives us the compassion that we need to treat them by meeting them where they're at. And a lot of that is changing the way that we do business so we can meet them where they're at and understand that. And one of the ways that we meet them where they're at is with detox. And we're fortunate that we have an amazing detox center that we do in the Center for Community Health over there. This obviously is a breakdown, but one of the things that you'll see on detox is used by law enforcement primarily as a place to drop off people that are intoxicated or high under the influence, that are a danger to themselves or others out on the street. And we can't drive around with them in the back seat of our patrol car until they sober up, so we drop them off at detox. And right in the center of the slide there, you see that the number of admissions per client, and that's significant, that we have people that are frequent flyers, people that often are in the community that we deal with, that we end up taking in there many times. The type of substance identified at intake, these are all self-reporting. The people tend to be pretty honest. In fact, my experience out on patrol is you ask somebody straight up, are you high right now? They will tell a fully uniformed law enforcement officer, I sure am. So they don't hide where they're at. And while they're not proud of it, they're pretty factual about it. Let's go to the next slide. Who's our slide clicker? So, anyways, with this slide with detox, we can see that the discharge outcomes, satisfactory completion, which means that you've stayed there until the staff is advising that it's okay to leave, and then detox isn't a place that we mandatorily can keep people. Once we drop them off as law enforcement, they can turn around and walk out the door if they want. It's not jail. We have no reason to legally lock them up, so they can stay for a cup of coffee and to get help that they need and have a safe place to sober up, or they can walk out the door, and you can see the numbers of that. And then we have significant polydrug use. And, you know, just to make an assertion here through the experience that I have as a law enforcement officer and having been on the Substance Abuse Advisory Board, is that many of these people aren't particular about the escape that they're seeking. If they can't, if they're normally a heroin user and they can't get a hold of their dealer, they're still medicating themselves, self-medicating for a reason. And if somebody offers them something else, oftentimes they will go for it. In fact, we just this year had Recovering the Northwest Project, which was a regional recovery, very well attended down at the Key. And as I was sitting at a table of people in chemical substance abuse recovery, it was brought to my attention for the first time, which you would think that, you know, I would have this figured out by now, that alcohol was the catalyst for many of them to use some of the harder drugs. That as we went around the table, one guy was telling me a story about his heroin addiction, where he tried heroin one time for 7 years. The impetus of that was he was drunk at the time he used his first heroin, which, you know, we consider alcohol to be something largely innocuous that's in our community, and we have it regulated, regulated, and we're going to talk about 502 in a bit, which marijuana in the same vein. But a lot of these people said, you know, if I had been sober, of course I wouldn't make a decision to shove a needle in my arm. But something about being intoxicated. And then as we went around the table, several of the other people, whether it was meth or heroin or cocaine or whatever, were like, yeah, I was drunk the first time I used too. So poly drug use is common. It isn't that people have a specific choice that they use. They'll use whatever they can to dull the pain. So then we have inpatient residential as well. And some people, actually, when we have beds available, can go from detox directly into an inpatient program. Unfortunately, one of the things that a gentleman from our community that you guys are probably familiar with, Ken Jennings, who's an advocate for those in recovery, said to me a long time ago, is that we have jail on demand. It's too bad we don't have treatment on demand. And unfortunately, because of many factors in our community, and funding is always one of them, we don't have treatment on demand for anybody. In fact, there's a lot of people that are indigent that their only access to treatment is through the jail and through court mandate to go get treatment. They can't walk in without medical coverage and request treatment and get it on demand. But we do have amazing inpatient treatment facilities. These are what people report as their primary drug use when they come into our inpatient treatment facility that we have. And as you can see at the bottom of the slide, this is inclusive of January through September of this year. Alcohol is a lot of the people that we end up taking down to detox, but you can see from the years and from the number on the slides how things changed. Heroin, obviously, in 2011 was much bigger than it is now, but it's still a big problem that we have. And then marijuana and meth, obviously, has dropped way off compared to where it used to be back in 2008, 2007. And then their secondary drugs of choice, after their whatever their primary drug of choice is, and you can see that as well. So one of the things when we say other, it's a very broad category, but there's synthetics, which we can't get in front of. Spice is an example of that, that we try to regulate spice by saying if you make spice using these 100 chemicals, then you can't do it anymore. And then we actually pass a law that says something like that, and then they just change one of those ingredients, and then it's no longer legally spice. So these synthetics that are coming up with, whether they're in pill form or they're just chemicals that they're spraying on other herbs and whatnot, it's been very difficult for us to get in front of. So then it becomes considered legal, like spice or bath salts, and then kids are using them and having terrible effects. So, yes, sir.
Question. This last year we put some money up for discharge when people come end up in jail, and as they come back out, it's meant to be for to help them in the direction they're going to go, whether it be mental health or alcohol abuse or whatever. I think we only have one position for that. We're hoping that that's going to be a good start to get people in the right direction. Like I said, you can't force them, but that might be one way to do it when they come out.
Oh, I think we're going to talk about that. Sergeant Tangen from the corrections branch is here, and the program that he's heading up over at the jail shows that folks that we have over incarcerated in that jail are ready for change. He'll talk all about that. But definitely, I think that if we provide somebody to give these people guidance, I think Sergeant Tangen can attest that they're ready to listen and they're just looking for that. So that help is greatly appreciated. So cost-benefit overview, we all know that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So for every dollar spent on addiction treatment, it produces $12, and that's from the SAMHSA. So we can see the savings over the years from the federal, state, to the local money that's spent, and multiply it by 12, and it's millions and millions of dollars of savings. But basically, this is getting out in front, and I know there's a delicate balance always between bridges that need to be repaired in this community and lives that need to be repaired. And there's a lot of people that drive over bridges, and unfortunately there's a lot of people driving over lives in this community, but many of those lives have children and next generations, and this dedication that we have to chemical dependency recovery, when we treat it as an addiction and we realize these people haven't chosen this choice, and when we've seen through the corrections branch that these people are responsive to change if we just provide them with a new path and give them guidance for it, it makes every one of these dollars very impactful. So, and we can see what the budget's been, the federal, state, for each fiscal year, and we see that it's reducing. One thing I can tell you from traveling, not only in the nation but in the state, is Clark County has something very unique here. The fact that we have that building over there with all the treatment facilities where people no longer have to get on a bus to go from one facility to the next facility to the next facility, carting kids behind them, that they can come to one building and take an elevator to go to the different departments, is something that other places don't have. And we've received phone calls from all over the nation asking how do we come up with that model. And hats off to Cleve Thompson and previous Substance Abuse Advisory Board years ago for making that happen. But had it not been for that infrastructure, the relationships that we have between our community coalitions, between our prevention, our treatment facilities, the Substance Abuse Advisory Board, and the Board of County Commissioners, our elected officials that are in touch and understand that budgets across the board have shrunk. But this shows how big a hit that we've been taking in this field, and we're still trying to do what we can because these people are in our community. And coincidentally, the people that Sergeant Tangen's working with at the Clark County Jail, those are our citizens as well. And when they come out of that jail, they come back into our community. So equipping them with new skills and helping them to battle this brain disease that they have and make them aware of that behooves us all. It benefits all of us. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Detective Barakas from the Clark Skamania Drug Task Force.
Hi. Clark Vancouver Regional Drug Task Force. The name changed since Shane left. I am Detective Barakas with the task force. I was asked to be here to talk about some trends that we're seeing. I just want to start kind of towards the end. I don't know if that's on the slide, but as far as spice and bath salts, as Shane briefly touched on, they just repackage. Repackage, add a new, take away a chemical. It's a constant. They don't label with these anymore with spice or bath salts because they don't want to have the recognition with that illegal substance. It's all about altering perception, about changing your feelings, changing your mood, having a good time from youth to old. There's new substances coming out all the time, be it plant substances or unknown chemical substances. We've been dealing with Kratom. It seems to be very popular. It's a plant form. There's nothing illegal to prevent it, but yet you can get very educated from the employees at all these head shops about the substance. They don't publicly sell this, as I said, the spice and bath salts, but they're constantly coming out with something new, relabeling some type of incense, but we usually don't get it until the backside when we hear either some high school kid has done A, B, and C, and this is the effect. To briefly talk about that, I just want to touch on marijuana really quick. We're buying from anywhere from a $20 bag to a pound via the internet. That's pretty widespread. Marijuana is for sale with anybody. Nothing has changed with the legalization or the decriminalization of it. Everybody is allowed to sell regardless if there's being revenue generated for the state or not. I look at prescription drug abuse and heroin as the same topic. I truly believe the prescription drug abuse problem created our heroin problem. Meth is a common stay. It will not go away. There are people, we have meth users, we have heroin users typically. They don't associate with each other. One thinks the other is, you know, an addict, and the other thinks the other is, you know, a straight line shooter. The prescription drugs, regardless of opinion, the overprescription of these prescribing doctors historically to take away pain had turned into abuse, which turned into availability for a lot of youth. And that created an environment where kids of all ages were able to take your pick, any type of Percocet, Adderall, whatever your flavor. These pills had come forth. Oxycontin was the big push for a number of years, which created our heroin problem that's now in our late teen and early young adults. There's a huge problem with that now. Heroin is going rampant. Again, our Hispanic friends of the South are producing the majority of all the heroin and methamphetamine and bringing it up still. Yes, sir.
Bath salts. Can you define it? I'm not familiar with the term.
There is no definition. It's a chemical compound. They labeled it bath salts because they were attempting to give things names that didn't associate with a drug. So they label this as bath salts, where many parents were, well, it's bath salts. Is this like Epsom salt, you know, where, you know, normal Joe Schmoes can get at the, you know, store? Well, they labeled this as bath salts, but basically it was any form of substance that was coated and injected with all of these chemical compounds that in turn made your body do something you were looking for the effect and intent. So if I'm looking to get high, if I'm looking to escape, there was many forms of bath salts, and we all hear the horror stories of bath salts and how it can change the brain forever, because there's no dosing, there's no approximate this, approximate that. They put these chemicals within any kind of a substance, just like spice. You can take grass off your yard and then spray it with all these chemical compounds. It's the same. It's really the same stuff, but basically they just merge in all these chemical compounds, and they can affect the brain with the intended use of escaping or getting high or whatever they want, but there's no real dosage there, so this is creating the kids that never come back, the kids that are now Alzheimer's patients and they're 19 years old, you know, the kids that have died. So basically they just take these chemical compounds, and there's a lot of smart people labeled as smart in these labs that create these compounds that create an intended effect for their sale, and they sell them, and they flood the market with them until, of course, government is steps behind, and by the time they catch up, it's kind of widespread, and that's what happened with spice and bath salts. So to give you a definition, a specific definition, there's not one. It's just really smart chemists developing something that hasn't been banned yet, and then pushing it out in the market, flooding it in the market, getting addiction, getting incidents, until there's some kind of legislature that makes a decision that says this goes away. Well, by that time, we've already lost how many lives or impacted how many lives. So, but again, prescription drug abuse largely is responsible for this, for over-prescribing. Many of the people we run into, I can get many informants to give me 100-300 pills from somebody that's been prescribed these pills, because that's how they maintain not only their drug addiction, but also their finances. So they will just in turn sell them for more money than, you know, they're paying for their prescription, which has caused a heroin problem. Obviously, we have needle programs, we have all this, but heroin is booming. It is booming, and largely caused from this prescription drugs. But for whatever reason, heroin used to be the dark drug and scary and needles, and it's not having that effect anymore. More and more people I talk to every day, the ones that would smoke heroin that had fear of needles are not having that fear anymore, because drugs are becoming more and more publicized as the norm, because there's so many things out there, i.e. marijuana, because it's just a plant, but it doesn't take much for a child to go, well, marijuana is a drug, but how much different is heroin? And we sit there and say, you know, there's all the debates about what marijuana really is, but when there's that step is not very far. So it's just creating the norm in our youth that says, well, I tried this, I'm going to step up, or I don't like how this makes me feel now, I'm going to step into something else. And that's what all these other drugs come to, because marijuana is usually that starting drug, but not necessarily these days because everything's so available. So, yes, sir.
I understand that they're lacing marijuana with some of this other stuff.
Absolutely, and they have been, and Shane briefly spoke about the poly drug use and things like that, but when you can put anything on marijuana, you can spray it with anything, you can mix it up, and there's so many things now with our BHO labs and things of that nature, where we used to be, you know, younger generations used to see a 4% marijuana, now we're seeing this 90%+, and they're going to talk about this, but it is marijuana crack is what it is, and it's affecting kids' brains, and we're seeing a rise of all kinds of drugs mixed in with marijuana. I mean, we're seeing, even lately, the last year, we're seeing an increase in cocaine, which I've seen very few times over my career, and I've been working in the drug unit for almost 11 years. So it's almost as though the floodgates are continuing to open because there's so much there, and if there's a market for it, they're going to sell it. So
the other thing that we're aware of is the e-cigarettes. And we anticipated that when they came on the market, and now I've seen it firsthand that they can insert anything they want into that, and that's what's so scary when they start lacing marijuana with the other stuff and they hide it through an e-cigarette. And I think our intent here is to address the e-cigarette situation again at our level.
Yes, and you're correct, and it's at the schools. It's everywhere. I mean, because it's looked at as supposedly a cigarette or some type of a nicotine. But, yeah, they can put anything they want in there. So if it burns, you know, so these kids, I mean, I've had people blatantly walk by me smoking weed, you know, that are probably 15, 16, you know. They don't care because that the vision of, ooh, it's scary, it's illegal, is gone. I mean, because it's like it's being publicly accepted, you know, and the nature's, you know, high, when in fact, you know, the marijuana created is not, it's full of chemicals. There's a reason, there's a difference between nature's way of creating a marijuana plant is not a hallucinogenic or anything close to it, but they've manipulated this plant and turned it into, you know, a beast with filled full of chemicals, but it, evidently, it doesn't harm you if you watch the news. So that's pretty much it. That's what I
get almost on a weekly basis. It's slowed down a little bit now. There's a doctor out of North County, and when marijuana started becoming real popular, and we never had a reason to really look at its effects before until it started being legalized, and she started sending me these medical reports from different doctors, and I have a book full of them now. And it'll just scare you to death, the effects of something as simple as marijuana.
There is a ton of people in treatment just for marijuana. It's amazing.
So, well, and speaking of marijuana, and Jeff touched on it, he called the VHO labs. So I think everybody remembers the days of meth labs. We're not far from that right now with marijuana labs. So when they're extracting the hash oil, we just had an explosion 2 days ago over in Portland at a place where they were doing exactly that, extracting the hash oil. So I think we're going to see more of that. Basically, the whole idea is you take weed and you extract the hash oil, and then you can infuse any of these products, to include the e-cigarettes in the top right that you mentioned there. But in the top left, like that granola bar, for example, it looks like a regular granola bar, but that's 2 to 4 doses of what somebody would consider like normally a joint. And when we're talking about marijuana, that's the issue anyways. Like, what is a dose? Because you don't know what the THC quantity is. It's not like a glass of wine where you know what the percentage of alcohol is in the glass of wine, because you don't know what the percentage of THC is and what chemicals were sprayed on it, either for bugs that might infest somebody's garden, or growth chemicals to try to get one plant to produce more bud. The impact of 502, basically it changed the definition of marijuana. So some of the unintended consequences, I think, from the passage of 502 is that our youth, and I know this from being the school resource supervisor, we used to be able to locally test marijuana, and we'd look at it under a microscope and we'd add some chemicals and say, yeah, that's marijuana. Well, with passage of 502, it changed it, because you have to measure the nanograms of THC that are in it. Well, that requires, there's only 2 labs in the state of Washington that can legally, officially test marijuana now. So we have a 16-year-old kid caught at school with marijuana. We're not going to spend the money to send that to the state lab for a misdemeanor. So most of the teenagers that are caught with marijuana, it results in school discipline. So instead of, and not that we're trying to start the school-to-prison pipeline anyways by racking up arrests of these kids, but at the same time we have them, they need to understand that there's consequences for their actions. And when those consequences are that there's a law that says they shouldn't have it, but that law is never enforced on them. And one of the other things that Jeff mentioned too, that he said that there's stores that are selling it, but there's still a black market out there. Well, I think local law enforcement isn't focused on marijuana because marijuana is controlled by the Liquor Control Board, so it's for the Liquor Control Board to enforce. So he has an informant that comes and says, we have a guy selling out of his garage. The Drug Task Force isn't even going to follow up on that because they're busy with heroin and methamphetamine and all these other drugs, because the Liquor Control Board is the one that's supposed to be investigating the marijuana sales, etc. Tax revenue regarding this, that there's other than, the county obviously has banned the sales here, but like for the city, which has accepted it, there's sales tax revenue, so the 8.4% or whatever for each sale that goes into the city. And then the city, I think, can do licensing or permitting fees. But other than that, the whole system of 502 is set up so that all the money that we talked about goes back to the state. It doesn't come down locally. So we're not getting that locally. And they're using that money to build the infrastructure of how this is going to work anyways, because Liquor Control Board has to hire new people to investigate anyway. So all that money that when we were told 502 would be a good thing and it ended up passing statewide, and I know it didn't pass locally, but we're not seeing any of that money locally anyways. Yes, sir.
So the Sheriff's Office does not enforce for the Liquor Control Board. They have their own enforcement staff?
Yes.
Oh, integration or cooperation?
Really? Run into marijuana cases at times, but that's definitely not our focus.
Is that the way it should be?
I think that's the way that 502 was written, so that it's...
Could change it, if you could optimize it, would there be more of a crossover?
We have we're integrated with Liquor Control Board in that if we were to come across somebody that's selling moonshine or something, we would contact the Liquor Control Board to handle that, because that's our area of specialty. And so there is that growth between, we used to handle this all the time, but now it's primarily their focus. So when we run into it, we still know what to do and how to handle it. But we largely, if we got this information, you remember a couple of years ago, we had Operation Gangrene, where we did 54 search warrants in a day, 52 or something. Anyways, which obviously shows that there was a huge black market of marijuana growing operations in Clark County. If we came across something of that size now, instead of us taking the lead on it, we would turn it over to Liquor Control Board to investigate.
I've never seen a Liquor Control Board officer. Are they... Uniforms like sheriffs do. You can tell that guy's some kind of an officer.
Most of the time, they're in plain clothes, and they're busy. They're very busy. They in fact they employ youth from 16 to 18 to do tobacco stings, from 18 to 20 and a half to do alcohol stings, where they'll send them in and try to get them to try to buy alcohol and see if a Minute Mart will sell them without checking ID, etc. They do those. I, as a patrol sergeant, have called them out to an event before where there were a lot of people that were visibly intoxicated, and get a hold of Liquor Control Board. They come right out to give fines, fees, whatever they need to do. So they're call responsive, and they do work with us, but they were already busy with tobacco and alcohol. And to dump marijuana on them, too, and then have them navigate the how is this going to work locally, they're very busy.
I think the problem still lies within the legislature, and it's something that we should give direction. We have a lobbyist that represents us on certain issues, and I think that probably should be one of them. I know early on it was They were going to keep all the money. We would have the responsibility of the prosecution and the enforcement and all of that. It wasn't very popular back then. It hasn't really changed a whole lot, and the enforcement now has gone away. So it's something that maybe we should be focusing from our angle with our local office.
And the state is currently already receiving tax revenue from marijuana sales, right?
Yes.
Is any of that coming back? Is it making any difference at all when it comes to enforcement?
Not locally. It's coming back through the Liquor Control Board. So we can't say that none of it's coming back because we have Liquor Control Board agents that are working here. But that money, there's no funneling system to go to local law enforcement or to municipalities that are dealing with the problem. The money is all going to build the system of enforcement for the Liquor Control Board. And so we're only seeing that through the efforts of the local Liquor Control Board agents.
Don't respond to liquor. On this, we call to complain or tell them.
I can't speak to whether or not they're developing informants or any of those. I mean, I can think of a call that you guys did in the past where somebody got ripped. He was running a store out of his garage in Orchards, and for all intents and purposes, glass display case, the whole thing, for marijuana sales. And he got robbed, so the police got called. And, of course, we went in and said, well, you can't have this anyways. But by and large, we're dealing with people that for years and years have been operating under the shroud of secrecy, and they don't call law enforcement. They enforce the law themselves. And, so whether they're out proactively seeking those people out or not still, I don't know.
There was a paper on that, and in that case, people ended up in the hospital. So it was a strong-arm robbery.
So following up on that same issue, so there is an expectation by the Liquor Control Board, two people in all of Clark County, and they do alcohol and marijuana, correct? Oh, and tobacco. So they expect assistance from local law enforcement, but I'm hearing that there's no provision to funnel some of the tax money back into our local law enforcement, either City of Vancouver or Clark County. Yes, and the other aspect of this, we are talking about human lives that get destroyed, and we're talking about people that are in the business of providing addiction. That's where the suppliers make money, is through someone's addiction. So there's no qualms or, I mean, it's a business to them, and they want the business to grow, and they want more to be addicted because that's more revenue. So it's really perpetuating the destruction of human lives. So one issue is, why do we have such a large part of the population, I guess, that isn't happy in their own mind? That's very worrisome to me, especially with our youth. Although we all were young one time, we all know about exploration and all that. You know, we're not just talking about kids that are trying it. We're talking about people that can have a lifetime of substance abuse. So I know the chemical, the genetic, the other factors of that. Another factor of this that we're not talking about is an extreme public safety matter, too. And that's, these are all cash businesses. So I know there was a home invasion in around the time where you did the big sting a couple of years ago, and it was because the criminals thought it was a drug house where there was a lot of cash, and it was simply the home of someone else in the neighborhood. That's dangerous, that these home invasions, somebody coming in thinking there are large sums of money. That's also a big problem. So
I know two people that have been involved in my... I focused primarily on Asian indoor marijuana growing for a number of years, which really housed the market. And I had two people that I dealt with within my cases that were homicides. They turned into homicides. They weren't in the local area, but they were suspects in our area that had moved because through Seattle, from Canada, Seattle down to here, marijuana was rampant. And two people that ended up getting killed for just that reason, strong-arm robberies, home invasion type things, and they were, it was over before it began. I mean, they came in and they basically just terminated these folks in the assumption that there was large quantities of money.
Okay, so let's move on to what we're doing for prevention and treatment. As Commissioner Stewart mentioned, is how do we handle these people that have this illness, and we are going to address treatment that we're doing. We're running a little bit behind, so I'm going to ask our speakers to kind of kick it up a notch, and if the commissioners can hold the rest of their questions till the end of the meeting, I'd appreciate it.
Margaret McCarthy. established in 2012. It is focused in Washougal, in the boundaries of Washougal School District. Our mission is building a community that is connected and involved, empowered by healthy choices and strong family units. Our substances that we are focused on reducing underage drinking, marijuana use, and prescription drug use. We are very similar to Tiffany's Coalition, to West Vanderfield Youth, in that our funding is also from the Community Prevention and Wellness. And some of the strategies that we use in our coalition are positive community norms. We use our healthy youth survey data as well as our community survey data and find the areas where there's a gap between perceptions and actual data and take those to encourage youth to know that most of the youth are making positive choices and correct those misperceptions. We also are working on restricting access. We've partnered with Prevent on a drug take back, and we also distribute prescription lock boxes to homes so that there's not as much access to those prescription drugs in the home. And we also have direct services of parenting wisely and guiding good choices to parenting education classes aimed at different age groups. One of them is for the middle school, the other is for the high school. And so those are some of the strategies we have in our community to promote healthy choices for our youth.
Okay, so I'm Joy Lyons, and I'm the coordinator for Prevent, and we are the countywide substance abuse prevention coalition, and we've been around since 2005 and received funding in 2007. So we are actually in year 8 of a 10-year grant cycle, which comes from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, so our federal government. It's a drug-free communities grant. We are housed within ESD 112, so they are a fiscal agent. And we work with many partners in the community, and our main focus is, again, very similar missions, visions, but we are primarily focused on environmental strategies, which really is, and I'll show you a slide in a minute about strategies, but policy-level efforts. And so through increasing awareness and policy, we're able to have sustainable change. So some examples of some of our projects, you've heard a few folks talk about the display of drug paraphernalia ordinance. We worked with the City of Vancouver, collected data. We have many community volunteers who do this work for us, and worked with the city to encourage the removal of the drug paraphernalia in stores where minors could enter. So rather than actually getting it removed, the city did pass an ordinance that stated that the products needed to be out of display of youth. And we know that that impacts our community norms. So you've heard from others about marijuana. And so we know that when youth go into a store and see the products, the Hello Kitty bongs right next to candy, that it influences their perceptions of what's normal or healthy even. And we had youth actually from Stacia speak on behalf of their own feelings about it and just what they thought was good and healthy for our community. So it was an awesome project. So we're very happy that that ordinance did pass. We have lots of projects that we do. We have a biennial summit that we help lead and implement at Clark College that includes over 200 middle and high school students for our Teens Care 2 Leadership and Prevention Summit. And that's just an incredible prevention opportunity for youth to promote positive behavior and focus on the positive instead of the negative. And we've learned through prevention science that that's what really works. Drug education is important, but we need all levels of strategies when we're working with our youth, and focusing on positive does work. The drug take-back you've heard about already, but just some numbers. This year alone, we collected over 2,000 pounds of pills through our partnerships with law enforcement and local schools and the Department of Environmental Services. We have a multi-tiered approach. You know, they want to keep the pills out of the river, and we want to keep them out of kids' hands. So it's an awesome project. And we had over 124 volunteers just this year alone. And the last two slides are really a visual infographic about our model for community engagement. All of our coalitions follow this model of 12 sector engagement, leaders within our community. That's how we make the most amount of community level change. So that means we have a representative from each sector that is a part of our coalition, and then can take the messaging and the campaigns and information back to their sector to spread the word. And Shane's our sector rep for law enforcement. We have various people in every single one of those sectors. The last one is our strategies. I already spoke to the comprehensive level that it requires for real community change to occur. So we provide information. Prevent is an educational resource to our community. We have many, many, many resources for schools in particular, but other folks in the community as well. But we provide information, and then we also focus on changing consequences, enforcement, modifying and changing policies. We know that our work is effective through data, and this infographic comes from the feds, basically saying that youth substance use has decreased among all grantees since the program inception. So the top three substances across the nation for youth are alcohol, tobacco, and marijuana, and that's why they show those top three. So thank you.
Hello, my name is Thomas. My name is Thomas Bright, Black Board member. So I'm here to talk about ATR. So ATR has been with the county for about 10 years, and we've served over 4,000 people. It's actually, Clark County has worked diligently with DBHR to develop what is considered a nationally acclaimed program. And a lot of this has to do with the linkage they provide or they utilize with nonprofits, Oxford, Department of Corrections, the Veterans Administrations, and many other nonprofits. It started about 10 years ago with a SAMHSA. The original grant was to help remove barriers to recovery. And since then, reviewing over 1,200 people, has showed the significant rates of positive change for those people that they have reviewed, to show that there had been a significant increase. And some of the numbers are actually over 400% of people have increased their employment, school, or job training since the inception. And then also rates of homelessness have decreased by over 70%, with a 44% increase in what's called semi-permanent housing, such as Oxford. And then also the grant had ended in September of 2014. So therefore we've been using for October, November, December local funds to be able to support that. So with that said, with all the success we've had with this program, we just want to thank you for your for approving the decision packet to sustain it for 2015. Thank you.
Hi, good morning. My name is Jessica. I'm a board member, and I also work in the therapeutic courts to provide mentoring services. So I'm going to talk to you about some of the grants that benefit our local therapeutic courts. The first is the Children Affected by Methamphetamines, the CAM grant. This grant is focused on children and their parents whose lives have been affected by methamphetamine use. The parents and their children grow through evidence-based neuropsychological testing, which is then used to refer them to the appropriate services. The parents also participate in parent coaching classes. CAM families are referred to services through the Family Treatment Court, and the CAM team is made up of a group of community stakeholders, including DSHS, court-appointed advocates, Family Treatment Court team, and peer mentors. The CAM grant has served 60 families, including 94 adults and 132 children. During the grant cycle, 9 drug-free babies have been born, which results in a savings of over $9.6 million over their lifetime. The next is a drug court enhancement grant. This is a 3-year joint SAMHSA and BJA grant totaling $625,000. The drug court enhancement grant increases community supervision and substance abuse treatment needs for therapeutic court participants. The interventions and services include 200 participants a year receiving home checks and curfew calls,
10 participants a year receiving Suboxone opiate medication therapy, and 75 participants a year receiving co-occurring treatment services. The program follows all key components of drug courts and includes 7 evidence-based design features. Next is the Juvenile Recovery Court Enhancement Grant. This is also a SAMHSA grant. It's a 3-year grant that totals $975,000. The Juvenile Recovery Court grant serves youth with substance use and dependency diagnosis in the Clark County Juvenile Court, ages 15 to 17. The proposal enriches the JRC program through enhancements including co-occurring treatment, recovery support services, job readiness skills and training, and community-based mentoring. The grant goals include assessing 90% of JRC youth using the Global Appraisal of Individual Needs Assessment, providing 20 youth per year with co-occurring treatment services, expanding the existing youth mentoring program Project Combine by matching 35 youth per year to mentors, enhancing job training for 20 youth through the Youth First program, and conducting a program evaluation through WSUV. It is expected the grant will serve 150 youth over the 3-year life of the grant. Anticipated outcomes include increase in program retention, decrease in recidivism, and expedience in matching participants to appropriate services. Co-occurring treatment will be provided for a full-time psychologist for JRC to implement evidence-based services. Community mentoring will build on an expiring program, Project Combine, which uses evidence-based community reinforcement and aftercare programs. Job readiness and life skills training will be provided by Partners in Career through their Youth First job readiness program. And then Project Reach 2 grant. Reach 2 is a consumer star born program that works in collaboration with the Clark County Therapeutic Courts to provide mentoring and recovery support services to the therapeutic court participants. Reach 2 has 21 trained alumni mentors that work with current court participants to guide them in their recovery. During year one of the grant, 153 incoming court participants were assigned a mentor, 73 participants made initial contact with their mentor, and 43 participants continued contact with their mentor and are active in the recovery community. In addition to peer mentoring, Reach 2 offers support through CVAB's other programs, including the Reach Center, which offers computer classes and support groups, and the Val Ogden Center, which offers employment support services. Reach 2 is currently 6 months into the second year of the 3-year grant, and we are planning expanded life skills classes, recovery activities and events for participants, and a therapeutic art studio. We hope to continue to grow, and we're starting to look for possible sources beyond the grant funding.
Kathy McNicholas, Vancouver Police. I just wanted to touch base before, I know it's not up here, but we didn't talk about the local tragedies of what 502's done and the prescription drugs with our local fatalities that we've had and people using and driving. So that funding to come back here to help us do those enforcements is a big piece of that, because I don't have the answer for those. There's 2 new programs we have in the county. Shane touched base on, as local law enforcement, when we come across someone under the influence, rather than taking them to jail, we use detox. When I started 20 years ago, there was beds available often. Over the last several years, it was always full, so we didn't have that piece. We'd have to take them to the emergency room, put them in there. Yeah, that's, you know, millions of dollars, and the hospital doesn't want them, and they don't want to be in the hospital. But that was our choice, or our only available place, because of community caretaking, getting them off the street. So the sobering unit is new. Lifeline Connections has gotten funded from Washington State through DBHR, so it's no cost to the citizens of Washington. And the only criteria is they're going to be under the influence, adults, and they'll come and stay medically staffed 12 hours. And so law enforcement, we can drop them off there. There's similar programs, Portland, Seattle, and Spokane, and they won't have to go to jail or the hospital. So this is that piece we've been missing, so we're really excited for that. And then there also is going to be services there. They will engage them for shelter, mental health services, treatment, and even employment. So that's a new thing we're really excited about. There'll be a 16-bed initially. I'd hate to say that we're hoping it doesn't expand, but I'm afraid we may have to have some more beds there. And that's in the bottom of 1601 East 4th Lane, the county health building and Lifeline Connections. The other one is the one we touched on earlier that Sergeant Tangen has the expertise in, but it started in 2013, the reentry program from the jail, engaging inmates on a voluntary basis if they'd like to participate in the reentry program. I won't read those to you, but these are all the groups that have come on board with them. And if someone's available to engage in that, they are offered the same thing, housing, help with housing, employment, a substance abuse problem, mental health services. We're challenged right now, once they get out, though, the post-release engagement to be able to follow up and continue their services and be successful. So we're still accessing if there is the success piece down the road. They do have treatments, and they can go have been placed into Lifeline for residential. And then these are all the other treatment and dependency assessments are performed on them before they go. And depending on the program they choose, they can be engaged about 4 to 6 weeks prior to their release from the jail. And some are a 90-day engagement prior to. And the only qualification, obviously, is voluntary, and that they were brought in from Clark County and then released back into Clark County. If someone's going somewhere else or to prison, they wouldn't be. And their behavioral in the jail has to be clean. They can't have had been a problem child initially. So that's all I have.
So we have some the Substance Abuse Advisory Board has some recommendations for you three as county commissioners. One is to continue to protect the funding of treatment in the county, wherever it may need to be, so that we have sustainability for our chemical dependency programs that are currently active in the county. Tom has a couple words he'd like to say about recommendations.
So we'd like to recommend that you continue to prohibit all activities related to the I-502. And also, the city has recently adopted an ordinance to ban paraphernalia in stores where children have access. So we'd like to ask that you might adopt something similar.
Yes, yes.
Office would have some feedback if that's exactly.
We actually worked with Prevent to draft the city ordinance, and so the ordinance that the city of Vancouver just passed about the drug paraphernalia would work for us as well.
When we come to you for our substance abuse board, you guys have been great and all the supporters, so just continue that.
And also, we do support the earlier adopter Medicaid model to help those who are seeking behavioral health services.
And lastly, we're going to look at the last slide, which is our collaborative relationships in Clark County. There's numerous outreach programs going on. Battleground has a resource fair, community wellness resource fair, Covington Middle School drug court celebration. Hands Across the Bridge Oxfest is definitely happening again this next year in September. Recovery Forum will be happening in September. Recovery Northwest Project will be happening in September again. It'll be the second year for the Recovery Northwest Project. So the Substance Abuse Advisory Board sees Clark County as a great place to be a person in recovery. And at this moment, I will address any more questions from the commissioners. Yes.
Bottom line, you're recommending they fall into two categories for us. One is to keep doing what we're doing. And there's only I only pull one thing out of here that says we need to do this two extra, and that would be the ordinance. So am I missing anything else? Any other changes that we can do?
I would just say I don't know what poll we have. Commissioner Mielke talked about the lobbyists to work with the legislature for 502 and where some of those monies are coming, but we would encourage that as well. And I'm sure the Washington State Association of Counties, I think, you know, other local law enforcement would like a piece of that as well.
on the same page there.
Well, I was concerned with Vancouver providing sales of marijuana, and then the forbidding of the paraphernalia. It kind of goes hand in hand, and how can you accept one and not the other?
So it wasn't.
Paraphernalia isn't the problem.
The paraphernalia just has to be out of sight. So it's almost like adult books or adult movies. I don't know anything about those, so Jeff will have to talk about those. But the idea is that we had several stores in the county and the city where we, Tom Breitbach was the first one that brought this to our attention, and we had a store that's no longer in existence called Bilo's out at 88th and Highway 99, and there was a horrific shooting that happened there a number of years ago. I'm not sad that that building's not gone, and a guy walked in and shot a guy in the head. The guy lived, anyways, at this store in particular was one of the locations where there was candy right next to drug paraphernalia, and unfortunately there are several apartment complexes nearby, and that's where a lot of people bring their children to go do their quick shopping, whether it's cigarettes or alcohol or any other thing that a convenience store provides. So in the city of Vancouver, we first tried to use a Pierce County model that completely banned paraphernalia from convenience stores, etc. And it wasn't met well by the city council, because the city council did not want to deprive store owners from having that source of income, I guess. So that's when we took the approach to, okay, what ideally we would like a ban on selling paraphernalia at a store where minors can enter, period. And I guess if we would bring forward a recommendation to you as commissioners, and if the sheriff's office, I guess Commissioner Mador, to address your question, if we could have a different, then yeah, we would want to ban completely on paraphernalia in stores where minors can enter, because we don't think that there are plenty of stores where you have to be of legal age to go in that sell that stuff already. We don't need our stop and shops.
That stood the test of being legally defensible?
We didn't pass it, so we can check into that. But I think that you can pass an ordinance basically saying that. Most of these stores, we had fantastic success stories too. Joy went out to Gear Road and Fourth Plain and talked to the owners of the store there and said, we don't want selling this paraphernalia. And they said, oh, we quit selling that stuff as soon as we bought the store. And we noticed that our clientele changed, and we've had an increase in business since we stopped selling that paraphernalia. We've also gone to other stores, which I don't know specifically which ones, and we've asked them, can you not sell this paraphernalia here? Because you're a convenience store, you sell gas, you sell... And they said, well, if I don't sell it, the guy down the street's going to sell it. So pass an ordinance that says that I can't sell it and I won't, but for the time being, that guy's going to sell it if I don't sell it, so I might as well make the money from it. So from some store owners, they understand that that's not their main focus. Their main focus is convenience store items anyways. But then there's other ones that would comply if it was an ordinance, and then...
And it does only ban it from view of children too. So it's about unfair exposure for children. So it's about norms. And if they see it's the norm, if they see it in every store that they go in their neighborhood, then it's going to be normal for them. So we already have a challenge with the I-502, and now we have in this continuing exposure to paraphernalia, and they have to explain that to children when it's sitting there at eye level when they walk in the store. So.
There's two choices. One is to hide it from view. The other one is to ban it outright. If you have access to a copy of the ban of that version as well, it would be helpful.
Yes, and we'll provide you with both of those, and also any challenges to that, because Pierce County's their ordinance was an outright ban. And one of the challenges we had on that was for a marijuana pipe, for example, a glass marijuana pipe, because in the court's eyes, it does not become drug paraphernalia until it's had marijuana introduced into it and it's been smoked. So for a store to sell a brand new glass pipe, it wasn't considered paraphernalia because it hadn't had marijuana introduced to it, and this is all before the passage of 502 anyways. So but Pierce County said, I don't care if it's a glass pipe. Pierce County's ordinance said, look, I don't care if it's been used for marijuana or not. We're calling it paraphernalia, and you can't sell it in your stores where minors can enter. So,
we have another problem that's out there, and that's buying marijuana medical cards can be easier to get than a parking pass. Are we able to address that in any manner?
Locally? So, locally we can't. It's marijuana, so the liquor control boards. So we're not focusing on, we will handle it when it comes up. There's a lot of education. I know that there's a lot of bills currently in that are trying to take recreational marijuana and medicinal marijuana and kind of marry them anyways, because the idea for medicinal marijuana was when recreational marijuana wasn't allowed. And even at that, there's some issues and problems. It is easy to get a card. I've dealt with people on patrol that had a marijuana card, and I smelled marijuana on his person, so I said, you've got weed, and he says, well, I have a marijuana card too, but it's expired. And I said, what do you mean it's expired? And he goes, well, there is no expiration, but doctors are writing expirations on the card just so they can get a fee from that person again to make them come back. So when I explain to the guy, your card isn't expired, it doesn't expire. If a doctor says you can use marijuana, you can use it for the rest of your life. That's the way the law is written. And I'm part of our job in law enforcement's education, and that's what I did on that day. But it is confusing. I don't think that we have as much black market subversion of medicinal marijuana that we had before. I think that a lot of the people that are in the medicinal marijuana market now are the legitimate medicinal marijuana people. Before I-502 passed, we had a lot of people that were doing the medicinal marijuana because they recreationally wanted to sell it for profit or do whatever. But
I have to assume that we honor Oregon medical marijuana cards.
Law doesn't state that, but we do. When it comes time for prosecution.
And that's where I'm familiar with the purchase or the easy access to those cards seem to be coming from marijuana. I mean, from Portland.
Medicinal marijuana in the state of Washington, the law specifically says a doctor licensed in the state of Washington. So if their doctor is licensed here as well, then that's fine. We had a Dr. Orvald from Yakima that would go over to Gresham and sign medicinal marijuana cards. So every now and then we'd get a Dr. Orvald card signed in Oregon, but we know he's a Washington doctor. That one's fine. But
having trouble getting prosecutions.
I'm aware we're way over, but it's a good subject.
One of the things I think I'm hearing here is that the passage of the recreational marijuana and even the medical marijuana was done way ahead of the state developing prudent, effective rules, regulations, laws. So if we were also going to focus on making a lobbying effort at the state, in addition to recovery money, treatment program money, are there specific laws that need to be enhanced, or do we have groups of law enforcement working on that so that whatever is created by the legislature is actually enforceable by law enforcement?
Banning medical marijuana. Any medical marijuana patient can have an exorbitant amount of marijuana. They've put these amounts in place, about 15 plants, a pound and a half. Even heavy smokers that I know, people are pretty willing to tell you about their smoking habits and usage habits. It's an excess. And wherever they got these numbers through their studies, it just enables somebody to basically transport a pound and a half at a time without getting in trouble. And even though there are a lot of medical marijuana prescribed out there. These people are selling weed. They are. There's no tax revenue generated from it. There's nothing to say that, except you're taking away their ability to grow their own. If the state is looking to get resources and obtain monies, then they're not obtaining those monies from those people with medical marijuana in the first place, let alone these people are all just selling for profit anyway, and that's what I see every day. So
medical marijuana was not, it was a measure passed by the governor and not the legislature. So I don't know what the method is to undo that, or if it takes a new governor's edict to eliminate it. So those are things we can look into. Any other? I mean, this really has become so difficult because of all the variations that are going on. It's very hard to get a grip on what we can even do to pass reasonable laws to help law enforcement.
Talk with what he's seeing with our cases that are coming file, or we can out, you know, well, your dog hid on the roach clip that my grandma left in the ashtray rather than the pound of heroin that's in the back seat. So cases like that, rather than getting rid of all our canines, we have to go through some little more question and answer about marijuana because it's legal. So as those come up, that may be something that Tony and detectives can get with you about cases that are laws that we need to close those loopholes. And I know that, like I told you, the driving under the influence with marijuana has been tragic in this last year for our community.
I'm Peter Solomon. I support the commissioners as well. One of the issues that comes up is that they have supported what you're asking for by banning collective gardens and retail establishments in the unincorporated areas. But how do we address a potential person operating one? It's a zoning violation. What kind of probable cause do we need to go and investigate that? Do you have any recommendations about how to enforce that, or how to identify those? I have a couple neighbors that are concerned that they have a collective garden or potential retail person selling marijuana next door. How do we enforce that from your perspective, or could you participate in this discussion going forward? Because at this point we haven't enforced those ordinances in any way from code enforcement.
Based on if I knock on any door, if I attempt to obtain a search warrant based on somebody growing, unless I have probable cause and pretty substantial probable cause, they're not going to let me get a search warrant into a home. If I knock on a door and I ask them, "Are you growing marijuana?" "Yes, I have medical marijuana." "How many plants are you growing?" 15. Okay. I have no probable cause to get in that house if they're growing 500, unless I can somehow show a diversion, electrical diversion, some other crime that I can get in another way. Well, this has been the fight we've had for a number of years. However, it's gotten even worse now because everybody accepts marijuana, and especially with this 15 plants, they all know, just don't let us in. I mean, sometimes we can get in, we can observe, but again, most of our time, because we're not putting assets in this, is because we just don't have the time, and we get people into compliance, even though down deep, what I know they're doing, they're selling for profit. Because I go in and they have 15 plants of any size, the state doesn't stipulate small, big, and they have 100. Well, those 100 plants, well, you always have the excuses. Some are going to go bad. Some just aren't, you know, good guys. Well, they clone everything now. It's the same plant. Has been for a decade. So we constantly fight this, but we're putting Band-Aids on it, because really, if we're going to invest all this time storage at the property unit with evidence, there's a ton of assets that go into this to fight it. And then on the prosecution side, we're not getting the support because they're not getting the support from the public, because marijuana is not a big deal. That's what everybody keeps saying openly. So for us to even get our foot in the door is a problem, let alone if we do, then it's a different fight after the fact.
So your question, Mr. Suleiman, I think would be an invited conversation that we'd love to have, because from the law enforcement angle, it's very difficult for us, and then prosecutions, expensive, everything. But if you're talking about zoning and you're talking about infractions and if you're talking about hitting them in with fines, that may get them into compliance quicker than law enforcement, actually, because law enforcement is difficult and prosecutor won't file on it anyway, so we do a lot of work and get nothing from it.
And that's exactly what I'm looking for. I looked at the law and said, wow, big, huge hurdle for you to come up with probable cause for a drug violation, but how do we move forward using some of your experience and background to help our code enforcement be able to enforce the zoning violation? I think that would be helpful for us.
So, and here's how the conversation will have to work, and I understand we're on record, and there is a real issue with law enforcement using other government agencies or organizations as our agents. So I will tell you right now that if you ever need our help, you are welcome to invite us, but we can't find a house and then say, you know what, it's too much probable cause for us, can you do something with it? And that's why that conversation hasn't happened yet, because we as law enforcement cannot use you as our agent to do that. But should you ever come across anything and you want to consult with us, we're here and ready to help.
Well, I would like to do that. We have some constituents that have reported a potential problem, so I'd like to request your assistance.
Absolutely.
In helping to address that. Thank you.
One last thing that I found in my notebook. Tonight, the Prevent numerous coalitions are meeting. I only have two handouts, so you guys are going to have to share. This is how five of the substance abuse prevention coalitions work, and it's happening tonight as an education forum. And we thank the three of you for your time this morning. And I thank all of my board for coming and supporting everything in the prevention coalitions. So therefore, that's the end of our 2014 year-end presentation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good job.
Thank you, guys.